Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show today. I'm very excited to introduce my guest, David Salmon, who is the founder and chief horticulturist at High Country Gardens. He spent over 25 years in pursuit of better plants for eco-friendly landscapes. And he's been using environmentally friendly practices when gardening long before organic became a household word. He's a native New Mexican, and he opened the Santa Fe greenhouses back in 1984, which was his first retail store. And he set out to transform Western gardening by cultivating and growing beautiful blooming perennials, native and ornamental grasses, and unique cacti and succulents. And after doing this, his water-wise xeric plants attracted a loyal fan base. And David changed the face of Western gardening from rocks and cactus to lush, blooming, eco-friendly garden habitats. And then when the demand for these plants extended beyond New Mexico, in 1993, David started High Country Gardens, which was the mail order division of the Santa Fe greenhouses. So that's kind of a longer, brief introduction. Welcome to the show, David, and go ahead and tell us a little more about yourself.
Well, thank you, Jackie. Well, I'm glad to be speaking with you. I was actually raised in Houston, Texas. I've been living here in New Mexico for, about 40 years, but technically I'm not a native, but I grew up in the piney woods of around Houston, and that's where I became very interested in plants and started to learn about Texas native plants by with my first couple of jobs working in a native plant nursery and in an herbarium in Houston. And that kind of piqued my interest in plants, and I decided from that point on that it was going to be my future. And so here I am many, many years later in Santa Fe, still working on plants and very involved in not only growing and selling plants, but also a lot of efforts toward educating consumers about better ways to garden and better ways to utilize plants in our landscapes to extend their usefulness just beyond being beautiful.
Excellent. Well, I know you're going to have tons of valuable information for the audience today. I know they're going to learn lots of valuable tips and tricks and just some exciting things about the options that are out there and how we can really care for our plant and still have just a beautiful yard and a beautiful garden. Because I think, you know, some people are afraid of that, oh, then it's not going to be pretty. And so I think that you've been really successful in helping people see how beautiful it can really be. So I was looking at your website and thought there were some great ideas there that we're going to try. So, David, I always do like to start the show by just asking about your very first gardening experience. You know, how old were you? Were you a kid, an adult? What'd you grow? You know, who were you with? How'd that go?
Well, let me see. I think my first serious gardening effort was in Taos, New Mexico. I was going to high school. In fact, I finished high school at Taos High. Oh. And planting a vegetable garden and a fruit orchard back in the early 70s. It was there were a few successes, but mostly blistered hands and not as many fruits and vegetables as I had originally hoped. But I guess that's always part of being a gardener, is you tend to be a bit of an optimist, even in the face of difficult gardening conditions, which certainly defined gardening in Taos. It's a very very cold climate, very short season. Oh, if you're lucky, you get about 90 days frost-free. So it was a great learning effort, and that really, I think, continues to today in terms of always wanting to learn new things about gardening, trying new plants and techniques. So it was a good kickoff to my horticultural career.
Now, I had a guest on just last week or so, I think, about who was from Santa Fe, and she was saying it's at like 7,000 or 8,000, in between 7,000 and 8,000 feet. Is Taos just as high? Is that part of the problem because of the elevation?
Well, you know, New Mexico, in fact, the lowest point in the whole state is 4,000 feet. But Taos is up at 7,000 feet, and Santa Fe is also at 7,000 feet. So the elevation has its pluses and minuses. Certainly in terms of pleasant weather, the high elevation is very nice because our nights cool down wonderfully. Very typical to have a 30 to 40 degree temperature swing between daytime highs and nighttime lows. But of course, for growing especially edibles and vegetables, that is not necessarily a very good combination for plants that like it warm.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of, well, we're certainly not at that kind of elevation. I think we're at 26 or 2800 here, but we definitely, I'm in Montana. I don't know if you know that. Have the cooler evenings, which is nice, but yep, can pose some difficulties. We had an early frost last year, like September 7th, I think, or something. We got down to 22, so that kind of got a lot of people last fall. But Taos and Santa Fe are both just beautiful, so I can totally understand why you would want to make it work there. So then, David, I like to ask people, like, what does organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, you know, it's evolved for me. Mm-hmm. I came up through kind of more of a traditional horticultural education. I'm a graduate of Colorado State University, and my degree's in horticultural science. So back then in the 70s, the emphasis was on traditional kind of chemical-based horticultural methodologies, and the concepts of organic gardening were still very, very fringe and certainly weren't considered mainstream. So I came from a very non-organic background, and over the years, as I was getting into business for myself, I was always looking for ways to make my customers more successful. And that was really kind of my introduction to organic gardening. But currently, I would say, to me, organic gardening is a very important way to protect ourselves and the environment from toxic chemicals, and also to get better results from our gardening efforts. And I think it's also for me, and I try and talk to people about this extensively, but it's for me, it's also a rejection of corporate agriculture and kind of the corporate takeover of agriculture with GMOs and all of the toxic chemicals that are used in traditional agriculture. And it is really also about protecting our soil. I think that's probably the thing that has suffered the most from conventional agribusiness and corporate agriculture. So I think organic gardening has meaning to me on several levels.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing all that. And that's so coincidental because I just recorded an interview, or kind of just like we're going to do just a little thing we're going to put out today, because on Saturday, so today's May 21st when we're recording this, and on Saturday, May 23rd, is going to be the Millions Against Monsanto March. And so I just had a friend of mine in the area come on, and she kind of just read her speech that she's going to give on Saturday about you know, the chemical industry and how they've affected agriculture in the United States. So I'm glad you brought that up too. Well, how perfect, right after I was just kind of editing it, and I'm going to just upload it this afternoon. Somebody had posted something on Facebook yesterday, and I was like, hey, you should, you know, say something on my show. So we just quickly recorded something because it's so important. And, you know, I just took this food survey the other day some guy calls me up and he's asking me these questions. And I was like, you know, I don't like any of those foods with GMOs. And he didn't know what I was talking about. And he's like, well, that's not an option. I don't have that. You can't check that box and blah, 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 blah. And then later on, he asked me about genetically modified organisms. And I'm like, that's a GMO. And it was just really funny. And I'm like, okay. And you're doing these interviews with people about their food consumption. It was just like, you know, all these questions about what do you buy at the store and how do you make your decisions and do you read the labels and if you do, what do you look for? He asked me, what do I look for on the label? And I'm like, and you have things to check off and GMO is not one of them, but whatever. So.
Well, I guess it's just an hourly a worker who just probably follows the script, but unfortunately, it's unfortunately reflective, I think, of many Americans who are not aware of these really important issues that are basically taking over our economy, and people aren't even aware of it. So, I think it's I salute this million person march against Monsanto.
I was just going to say, the other thing I like that you had said in your first sentence was that you looked into organic in order to make your customers more successful, and that by growing organically, they were getting better production. So I thought that was a nice thing that you said there.
Well, I think that it really started with the soil, because gardening here in northern New Mexico, we have typically very heavy clay soils, and many visitors to Santa Fe always enjoy and marvel at our adobe architecture, basically building with mud bricks. So our soil makes fabulous mud bricks, but it's a challenge to garden in. And so that was kind of how I approached, or how I came to appreciate the value of organic gardening, was how to improve and enhance our soils to make our customers more successful. So if you would, it's basically starting organic gardening from the ground up. And, you know, we were always out looking for new products. This was before there was a commercial compost suppliers where you could actually buy compost in bags and that sort of thing. So it was a very educational and illuminating experience, you know, 30 years ago, trying to find innovative products for people to enhance their soil, make their soil healthier. And of course, back then we didn't really have the knowledge of about soil and what goes on underground that we do now. So it was a gradual process.
So is that what inspired you to start using the organic techniques, was trying to help your customers?
Yes. You know, It also helped me, because one of my original tenants of when I founded my retail greenhouse and garden center was I wanted to plant extensive test and ornamental gardens to show customers what the plants that we sold looked like when they would mature. Oh. And of course, in addition to making my customers more successful with different soil building products, I also used and tested it myself in my display gardens. So it really was kind of a two-pronged approach in terms of gardening success, both my own and my customers.
You know, that's just a great idea. I'm trying to think of like the nurseries in the area, and do they even have display gardens? Like, that's a great way to show your customers, like, this is what I'm using, this is what it looks like. I really like that. So then,
unfortunately, it's not widely that's not widely practiced. I think most garden centers, you know, it's just such a tough business, and there's always so much to do, and gardening is often the last thing that gets done. But I think it's probably the most important approach for teaching and showing people how to garden successfully is by doing it yourself and showing folks what the plants do and how to grow them and what they look like.
And then you probably, like, if you had other people working with you, then they were pretty educated about what they were doing too, which is always nice, because you know how frustrating it is when you go somewhere and you ask questions, and you can tell that you, the person you're talking to doesn't really know as much as you do, or they can't always find your answer. So if they're, if you,
sure.
I'll bet that helps too. So then how did you learn how to garden organically? Was it just trial and error, or did you?
Well, it was basically a trial and error. And it was trying a lot of different products, either successfully or not successfully. So I really didn't have a set curriculum that I went through to learn organic gardening. You know, I've been obviously gardening most of my life, so I knew how to garden, but it was a lot of it actually was kind of unlearning how I was taught to garden and how to grow in the greenhouse because, of course, as I mentioned, I came up at a time when organic gardening techniques really were considered very fringe and questionable, and a lot of the university research and publications and whatnot were very traditionally oriented.
Okay. I don't know if I lost you there for a second. Do you just want to repeat that just in case? It looks like it recorded it, but just in case. Sorry.
Sure. Well, basically it was just my education and background was based on using traditional chemical inputs for pest controls and soil fertility and whatnot. So I really had to kind of move outside of my comfort range to learn organic techniques because that's just not how I was taught. But again, going back to my eternal search for new products to make my customers more successful, that was a big part of it because I would get samples of you know, insecticidal soaps or various composts and things like that. So it was a combination of both a product testing as well as in the garden use to determine what the best way to get it done and what were the best products to utilize.
Excellent. Well, I'm so glad you've shared your knowledge with so many people and you're sharing it with us today because, that you know, that's what it's all about is learning from each other and having studied it as long as you have and been doing it, like, you know, physically, like actually putting it into practice. I'm sure you've learned the best things. And I really like the way you talk about making my customers successful. So that's cool. So tell us about something that grew well this year, or maybe, you know, it'd be last summer.
Well, I tell you, Jackie, it's been a real challenge. We've been in the grips of just a catastrophic drought. This is we're getting a little bit of reprieve this spring, but it's been going on for nearly 5 years. So I don't think I had a great deal of success last year between the lack of rain and the rabbits and chewing everything to the ground. It was a challenging year.
Wow.
So I can't really say I had any incredible successes, although what I did learn from last year that in a drought year, it's best in terms of ornamental gardening to get a very early start. So if you can get plants into the ground as soon as the soil thaws and get them growing and rooted out before the weather changes and gets hot, that in general that made for a much better success rate, even though it still wasn't that great. It was much better than waiting until, you know, after frost, last average frost to plant. So I guess that's the thing that I learned most last year gardening in the drought.
So then in your drought, like, can you even water, or do they like limit your irrigation and everything? Like, is it that bad?
Well, it's a little different now. Santa Fe now gets a lot of our water from the Rio Grande, which is the main river that dissects through the middle of the state. But, you know, we've been in drought. Actually, for us here in New Mexico, drought is the norm, and normal years are the exception. And it's been that way since about 1996.
And is there anything that like happened in 96 that caused that, or just it's just been that way because just the planet's getting warmer and stuff in general?
Well, I'm not sure in terms of climatology what happened, but the first couple of droughts we did have severe water restrictions, and at one point we weren't allowed to plant anything. There was a planting ban. We were only allowed to water outdoors once a week. But
Wow.
it was and then the big drought hit up in Colorado in 2002 and 2003, and they were just going nuts up there and trying to deal with it. But for us down in New Mexico, we'd already this was our second or third drought just in the in that decade. So we were a little more familiar with trying to save water and watering efficiently and using water-wise plants, those sorts of techniques.
Okay. Well, should we talk about that a little? Like some water-wise plants or some techniques that you can use if you're in a drought situation?
Well, I think it's really important. Certainly, the drought in California has gotten a lot of recent publicity and coverage in the media, and people's reaction to it to the drought vary from, good common sense gardening to the absurd. And probably one of the most absurd things that people do in a drought is they rip out their lawn and cover it with gravel. That's a really kind of knee-jerk reaction, but it's also encouraged by many municipalities because, of course, they have not done any drought planning or education prior to the drought. So they just say, well, we'll just pay people to rip out their lawns so that it will save us water. But in the long term, that just encourages and enhances the urban heat island effect, which, since many Americans live in urban and suburban areas, the urban heat island effect is very, very serious because it actually makes it hotter and drier and puts even more stress on water resources. So I think that the first thing that people have to do in a drought is not overreact.
So what would you recommend for people to do with their lawn then? Would you say keep a lawn, or would you would plant some native like grasses or things, or what would you do? Recommend that people do then?
Well,
What kind of education would you like to see the cities and governments implementing?
I think probably the most important thing is just to stop watering the lawn as much. Many of our common lawn grasses, like Kentucky bluegrass, it's actually the only reason it's green in the summer is we water it so much. It actually wants to go to sleep in the summer. It's a cool season grass. But I think the most important
Oh.
thing about for example, if you live in Boise, Idaho, I know a lot of people there, they just traditionally let their lawns go brown in the summer, which, to many people is just the ultimate horrible thing to do because we've all been trained that big green lawns are the only way to landscape. But anyway, the real detrimental thing about ripping out your lawn is, unfortunately, many of our shade trees are connected underneath the lawn to that water. And so when people rip out their lawn and stop watering their yards, the first thing to go is their shade trees, which if you've got,
See, I was wondering.
20, well, it's a big problem. You've got 20 or 30 years in growing that big, beautiful shade tree. And then just to save yourself a couple of $100 a month, you let it go and it dies off. So, ripping out lawns can be extremely detrimental to the urban forest canopy. And of course, when your shade trees die, then your house is hotter and your electric bill goes up and actually water use increases because somewhere they're burning coal probably to generate the electricity to cool your house. So they're just using that water somewhere else. So generally, lawns just instead of watering them every day, just stop watering them. But if you have trees that are plugged into your lawns in terms of their roots being underneath the turf, then give it a good soaking once a month just to keep your trees alive, because lawns can be replaced, but trees, you know, if you've got 30 years in your tree, I don't care how much money you have, you're not going to buy back time. So people really need to prioritize what's important, and I say the most important thing are your trees. Shrubs, those can be replaced.
Excellent.
But trees are the, you know, really important part of our landscapes, and they provide a lot of benefits that to mitigate, to kill them because we've got a drought is just insanity.
Oh, I just love everything you've shared about, you know, how connected everything is. You've done a great job of really talking about thinking ahead and thinking about, you know, the relationship of everything as an ecosystem, and don't just, you know, because all of a sudden there's a drought, just quit watering your lawn or just ripping out your lawn and thinking that's the only solution, like having different options out there. And yeah, certainly shade trees are very important. As a matter of fact, my husband was talking about cutting this big tree down that's shading part of our garden. And I looked at him and I was like, you know, we might want that shade come August because we were just planting the peas and his potatoes. I can see where this big tree is, like the potatoes that aren't shaded by this big tree, like on one end of the garden are growing twice as fast as the ones that are getting the shade. But I'm thinking, you know, a month from now, 2 months from now in August, it might just go the other way. So,
well, you know, it's we have to look at our gardening efforts in relation to time, and you know, you can never get that time back. So, things in our yards that we've spent many, many years cultivating, we want to value those the most, and some of these other crops, maybe it could just be moved or something like that, but I think it's really important to value our plants, and particularly the more years they have in the ground, the more valuable they become.
Nice. All right. Well, so then is there something you're excited to try next year, something new or different that you're going to do?
Well, you know, I'm looking at a lot of lawn alternatives in terms of plant materials. I think that the tide is starting to turn a little bit in vis-a-vis lawns and covering our landscapes in terms of using different plant materials than lawn grasses, because I think it's a combination of factors that people are becoming more accepting of lawn alternatives, like using ground covers for areas that don't get any foot traffic. And I also think that people are starting to become more aware of the benefits that a well-done landscape can give back to the environment, can give back in terms of supporting our pollinators, bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, that sort of thing, that a garden is starting to become more than just something that your yard service takes care of, and that lawns are really just a kind of a nightmare in terms of when it comes to I think that lawns are such a monoculture situation that they really don't do anything particularly useful, and certainly in terms of providing habitat, you couldn't find a less useful plant in terms of supporting pollinators or things like that. And also, I guess the third leg of that would be some people are starting to understand that our traditional lawn care methods are, you know, we're poisoning ourselves and our immediate environment. So I think a lot of things are starting to shift when it comes to lawns, and people's thinking is starting to shift in terms of how can that part of my landscape be used more productively.
Yeah. You know, I was somebody at the beginning when I first started the podcast, I was talking to a guest about, you know, maybe that's something that we need to reach out and start educating the landscaping companies, that people, that if they start getting into organic, if we could somehow shift their mindset so that when they start talking to customers, they could be like, you know, these are other options and not just automatically go to the chemicals. And maybe they're kind of some of the people that we need to educate a little. So I don't know if that could be a business for someone down the line or where that might lead, but just something I started thinking about since I did the podcast that somebody was saying something about, you know, well, the gardener just comes and, you know, the landscaper just comes and they put that on there and I don't really have anything to do with it. And I thought, oh, well, maybe, you know, that's who we have to kind of educate a little too. I don't know.
Well, I think that probably the most important, if we were going to do one area in terms of converting to organic techniques, it would be lawn care, because we use more chemicals on our lawns. I think the latest figure, there's approximately 10 million acres of lawns in the United States now, and probably 9.9 million acres of that is taken care of with the use of chemical fertilizers, fungicides, pre-emergent herbicides, insecticides. Basically, it's all-out war on nature when it comes to lawn care, and that paradigm just has to shift. It just has to shift because it's indicative of our overall kind of ignoring our landscapes, not being aware of what the lawn service is using on our lawn, and wondering why our kids are sick and our dogs get cancer and all of the other things that are tied into that. And probably most of all is all the huge corporations that are invested in keeping us taking care of our lawns chemically. So it's, you know, if you want to protest the Monsanto and Monsanto-type corporations, the best thing you can do is tell Scott's Weed and Feed to go take a hike and convert to organic lawn care. People will save water and save money. So it's just common sense gardening, but people don't give it a lot of thought.
Excellent. I like that. And one of my guests, John Moore, who lives over in Australia, and he has this thing called the World Organic News. He was talking about the other big one are the golf courses, you know, that they're another place where they use big chemicals and pesticides. Okay, I won't get you started. How about tell us about something that didn't work so well this season, then, I guess. Sounds like quite a few things down there.
Well, what didn't work very well? I tell you, I didn't do a lot of planting this past year because of the intensity of the drought. So a lot of what I did didn't work very well. But I would say in a normal year, when drought and lack of water isn't such a concern, I would say planting ornamentals that aren't, you know, I always think that, oh, I can outsmart this plant and make it work in my garden. But I think that trying to plants that aren't well matched to my soil has been probably my most recurrent gardening failure. Thinking that I can amend my soil to make it right. So I don't know if it was any one specific plant as much as just realizing that you need to match the plant's soil preferences to the soil you have in your yard and not fool yourself to think that you can change the soil enough to make it work.
Okay, cool. I like that advice. How about, is there anything that you find that's easy to grow down there and is generally successful every time? Something that people might want to put in?
Well, ornamental grasses are generally a pretty no-brainer plant for the landscapes. You know, and when
so, do you want to tell them just in case they don't know what that means?
Well, an ornamental grass is typically not a lawn, although some people might interpret ornamental grasses as being a lawn. But ornamental grasses are generally more clumping type grasses that have height. You know, they might be 6 inches tall or they might be 6 feet tall. But the ornamental grasses are just very adaptable. They're not as showy as a petunia or a dahlia or what many people would consider a garden plant, but they have a subtle beauty and a habitat and environmental value to the landscape that exceeds most other plants. So ornamental grasses, not only do they look nice during the growing season, but when your garden is asleep in the winter, they provide a lot of winter interest, and with their beautiful seed heads and things like that. So ornamental grasses are a great way to go, and there's just so many new varieties that I think it's time for people to start experimenting with them if it's a plant that they're not very familiar with. But it's very easy to grow, and they grow quickly, and you'll see the results of your gardening efforts with ornamental grasses fairly quickly.
Nice. I like that. I'm always results oriented, so that sounds perfect. How about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, I think that I take a little bit bigger approach, Jackie, other than just saying, okay, well, here, plant A or plant B, just stay away from that. I think that people will have a lot better success if they understand the conditions that they're going to be gardening in. In other words, know what your soil type is.
Excellent.
Are you gardening in clay? Are you growing in sand? You know, what's your soil? And then I think that folks need to make a concerted effort to match the plants to their soil. You know, if you've got clay, then seek out clay-loving plants. If you've got a sandy soil, seek out plants that do best in sandy soils. And then thirdly is educate oneself about what are regionally suitable plants. In other words, I've seen this so much over the years as people move to New Mexico from Connecticut. And so the first thing they do is go looking for azaleas and rhododendrons, which, you know, are just a complete waste of time and effort. They just won't grow here. I don't care if you're Harry Potter with a magic spell, but you're not going to get those things to grow. So people really need to understand the meaning of a regionally suitable plant. And then out of that regionally suitable plant palette, match the plants to your soil.
Excellent. I like that. That's a great way to think about that too. Okay. So how about, is there an activity that's your least favorite to do in the garden? Anything you got to force yourself to get out there and go do?
I would say probably repairing irrigation systems. You know, gardening out here in the West, you have to irrigate to really have much of a garden. Otherwise, it's kind of like a reclamation project. So unfortunately, we have to deal with irrigation on a continuous basis, and repairing irrigation systems is just at the bottom of my to-do list every time.
Okay, I can totally understand that. My husband and I just put a well in, so we've been kind of like water starved for years, even though where we are, and like we had dug a shallow well back in 1999, but that didn't leave us enough. Like, we could grow some stuff, but we certainly couldn't water our lawn. And then we put in, the year we dug the well, we put in an orchard, but then I don't know, we ended up just barely getting it hooked up last year. So this is really the first year that we have watered, but we learned a lot about when you're hauling water or you have very limited water, you make sure that water goes to the roots. And but definitely irrigation and any kind of watering, I understand the trials and tribulations, and even sometimes dragging the hose around. And my husband's got a lot of corners in the yard, and it can take quite a while to water just what little bits that we did have. When we would have, like, we had a water truck, and we would gravity feed it from a hose. We could haul like 1500 gallons of water at a time. And just sometimes even the hose would get caught, or just different little things. So probably not the big problems that you have though. So what's your favorite activity to do in the garden?
I would say probably pruning.
Oh.
I love to prune. And seed collecting. I raise a lot of my own seed that I grow my crops from. So I spend a lot of time cultivating plants for their seeds. And when it's time to start collecting the seeds, that's one of my favorite times, either out in the garden or out in habitat in the mountains and plains. It's a very satisfying activity. And then once you collect them, of course, you got to clean them and weigh it and package it. So everything about seeds is definitely one of my favorite things.
Okay. And then pruning trees or bushes or?
Basically everything, you know, whether it's kind of clipping back the garden at the start of spring to make room for all the new growth, or pruning my fruit trees, or pruning my flowering ornamental trees, or my shrubs. I like to have a pair of clippers in my hands.
Okay. I think, got any tips? Because I had this guy, Russ, how'd you say his name? Medj from Utah, who talked about fruit pruning fruit trees, and that has been the number one episode. It was episode number 27, I think, and he's got more listens than anybody else. I think you're going to be episode number 50. I'm pretty sure. And so you got any tips for people? Because apparently they're pretty interested in that, for pruning fruit trees.
Well, you know, pruning fruit trees is a giant topic unto itself. Mm-hmm. I would say, unlike fruit trees, when you're pruning shade and flowering trees, people need to stop topping trees. That's probably the number one thing to learn about pruning, is that when you top a tree, you cut the tops off of trees. That's basically herbicide. That's killing your trees. So for goodness sakes, get some basic books on pruning and learn the correct techniques in terms of where do you cut to remove a small branch? How do you
Okay.
Prune suckers. You know, there's that's a lot of, particularly this time of year, is just getting rid of all the suckers that come up from fruit tree rootstocks. That's very important, to not let the suckers steal energy from the part of the top of the tree that you want to grow. And then the time to do the pruning, generally, once the trees have flowered and leafed out, people want to go very moderately in terms of how much wood they're removing from the tree. Heavy pruning needs to happen when the trees are dormant.
Okay.
I would say that's an important point. Firewood. It's a little bit related to pruning, but always keep firewood well away from your trees, because there's so much damage being done with pests being introduced to landscapes from infested firewood.
Really?
Oh my gosh. And in terms of like pine and spruce borers, the emerald ash borer, solarize your firewood. In other words, if you get firewood, cover it with clear plastic and just bake the heck out of it to kill any beetles or larvae in your firewood. That's super important. I have a little bit of a stretch from pruning, but a lot of people create firewood.
No, but that's really important.
Really, really important. And if a nursery sells trees and firewood, keep going.
Really? Okay.
Don't buy. I see that. So much.
Okay.
Otherwise, of course, borers don't attack vegetables very much, but when you're pruning and creating firewood, solarize it. Don't give a problem to your neighbor by selling them if you have diseased or infested trees. Be very careful with that wood, because it's a source of a lot of potential damage.
Mm-hmm. And it's bad in places, the pine beetles and things. So, and then we had
Oh,
a
it's
problem
horrible.
with the fur that came through Montana, and I want to say it was in Colorado like 10 years ago, right? That was coming through and turning all the fir trees red. I know over it hasn't been as bad, knock on wood, in our area, but over by Helena, where our capital is, on the other side of the mountains, the Continental Divide, it's really bad. Their forests are just dying. It's so sad to drive through there and you just see tons of red trees. So we've been
Well, that's
kind of lucky here.
exactly the wood that you don't want to bring and
Right,
put
no.
near your healthy pine
No.
trees, because you'll be bringing
Yeah.
in a problem.
That's
But
interesting.
well, anyway,
Actually,
I don't
the
know.
very when Mike and I first met back in 1991 or 90, I think, we got in this huge fight. We were planting trees for the Forest Service for a contractor, and I was like the little hippie environmentalist saying, we should never cut down another tree again. And he just jumped on me right away, and he's like, you environmentalists, we have all these trees that have been killed by the pine beetle, and we've got to get that wood out of there. And then, you hold up the timber sales, and there's just, the pine beetles just killing all this wood, and we've got to get it out of here. And we fell in love anyway, but it was funny. Our first,
Well,
very, very first conversation was a giant fight about the pine beetle in the lodgepole pine trees. So that's interesting that you said that, but I don't know. We've certainly burned a lot of firewood at my house. So, all right. Well, those are great tips. Okay, and then was there anything more you wanted to say about seed collecting at all?
Well, in terms of I know a lot of your listening audience are vegetable gardeners, and I think collecting your own vegetable seeds is just super important, because it only takes approximately three generations of selection to begin to adapt a vegetable to your own climate. And there's a place for hybrid vegetable seeds, but I think that the heirloom vegetable seed movement is a very, very important one. And it's a seed collecting is a really a great way to get in touch with your plants, because that's the best way to start to understand their growth cycles, how the weather and rainfall affects their health and ripening time. I think collecting seeds, even though it's kind of at the very end of the whole gardening process, can teach you a lot about the gardening process from the very beginning. So I encourage people to save their own seeds, but learn about it a little bit. Learn what seeds will cross-pollinate and which ones won't. Tomatoes are a great thing to save seeds, because they rarely cross-pollinate, and they just self-pollinate and come true from their own pollen. So seed
Okay,
collecting
I
is
was
a
just gonna
great
ask
thing
you,
for vegetable gardens.
can you explain to listeners what that means by cross-pollinate versus self? I guess self-pollinate sounds kind of self-explanatory, but just.
Well, the whole purpose, a plant's entire purpose, of course, is to set seed. They want to propagate themselves. And plants can become pollinated in two ways, either via the wind, like corn. Corn's basically a grass, so grasses are wind pollinated. And if you have if you're planting some sweet corn and some popping corn, those will cross-pollinate, and your seed corn will be worthless if it crosses with popcorn. It will lose all its
Oh.
sweetness. So that's an example of cross-pollinating. If you want your corn to come true from seed, I think you have to separate it by, what is it, like a quarter or a half a mile.
Oh.
Where tomatoes self-pollinate. Bees will vibrate the flowers, which stimulates the pollinating process. But if you have two tomatoes growing side by side, 99 times out of 100, they will come true from seed because they self-pollinate. Now, let's see. So if you're going to save your own vegetable seed, do a little bit of research and learn which plants will readily cross-pollinate and which ones won't, and plant accordingly. In other words, if you don't want something that readily cross-pollinates, you need to isolate it from another variety of that same plant so that it will breed true. It's not very complicated, but you just have to become acquainted with the basics of how plants pollinate themselves and who and what is involved in the pollination process.
So then do you have to worry about that with trees, too?
Like putting
apple trees close together of different types of apples? Are they going to... and fruit
that
trees
apple
and
seed things? Is worthless. It's worthless.
Apple
because
seed
you don't know what... Yeah, because you don't... Well, it takes you probably at least 6 to 8 years to have a... it's a long time from seed to fruit. So if you spend 8 years and you don't have good apple seed, you've just wasted your time. You'll have no idea what eventually will show up. So that's why a lot of fruit trees, they're grafted. So you take a piece of a known variety and you graft it onto a rootstock. Almost all fruit production is done asexually, either by grafting or rooting of cuttings, and not from seed, because fruit trees cross-pollinate at the drop of a hat. Because the bees are busy going from tree to tree spreading the pollen. They don't just fertilize Red Delicious or Yellow Delicious. They go between those two varieties, and you don't know what you're going to come up with down the line.
Oh, okay. All right, well, we better move on. I guess I'm kind of looking at the clock. I don't want to keep you here all day. How about, what's the best gardening advice you have ever received?
Feed your soil to feed your plants.
Okay.
I think that's the very basic tenet of organic gardening. Is when we say it incorrectly so much, I'm going to go out and feed my plants, which, of course, if you're using chemical fertilizer, that's exactly what you're doing, because the soil has nothing to do with the process. The chemical salts, once they're dissolved in water, physiologically, plants will automatically take up these soluble nutrients, and it bypasses the whole soil, the whole living soil process. So that was a huge realization that to garden organically, we have to feed the soil to feed our plants. And that was probably the longest lasting piece of gardening advice I've ever gotten, and it's still my mantra.
Excellent. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
I'd probably say my Hori Hori knife.
Oh, cool.
It's a Japanese gardening tool. It's basically a not-so-sharp knife with a serrated edge. And it's excellent for weeding, planting, cutting. It's just a great little portable tool that if I don't have it on me, I have it in the door panel of my truck, so it's ready. It's nearby.
Cool. I had another guest, these two girls from New York who have a CSA and a little farm there, and that was what they recommended too. They said they couldn't live without their Hori Hori knives.
It's good. And then if you're attacked by a grizzly bear, you've got something to fight back with. So.
All right. That could happen for sure where I am.
Definitely.
How about secrets for preserving food? Like, do you do any canning or drying or anything for making food last a little longer?
Oh, gosh, I'm so bad about that. That's what organic markets are for.
Well, how about, you know, I used to do flowers? Like, do you pick bouquets or anything? Because I know you do a lot of flowers. Like, got any secrets for making flowers last longer in a vase or anything like that? Or...
Oh, absolutely. Now we're talking.
Cool.
I just don't do, I've never done much vegetable gardening here in Santa Fe because our water is so expensive. I think if I raised all my own tomatoes, those things would be about $10 a piece by the time I paid my water bill. So just don't do, I don't do a lot of vegetable gardening, but I do enjoy cut flowers tremendously. So probably a couple of things on cut flowers. Be sure your vase is clean. If you don't want to drink out of the vase, then don't put a flower into it. Make sure it's good and clean. Run it through the dishwasher.
Oh, I like that.
And I like using the Floralife. It's a combination of, I think, some simple sugars, and I'm not sure what else is in it, but the Floralife really does extend the life of your cut flowers. And then finally, like, for example, roses, you always need to make the final cut before you put it into the vase. Cut your roses underwater so that they don't suck any air bubbles in. That's why roses a lot of times will just fade in the vase. It's because you didn't cut the recut the stem underwater before you put it into the vase. So in general, that's a good idea, is just to recut the stems underwater before you put them in the vase.
Okay, excellent. How about a favorite internet resource? Is there anywhere you like to go on the internet to find information?
Well, I use the USDA Plant Profile website a lot. Mainly, that's plants.usda.gov. And I use that website a lot to find out where plants are native to. So if I'm doing research on a native plant, I use that website a lot to find out where in the U.S. a plant can be found natively in habitat.
Excellent. How about a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or any kind of blogs that you really like?
Well, I love the Colorado Gardener. It's a quarterly newspaper. Excellent. I read more interesting articles in the Colorado Gardener than just about any place else. And then I like, it's now called the Rocky Mountain Gardening Magazine, or it used to be, it changed the name, it was Zone 4.
Oh, okay.
And that's a particularly excellent magazine for folks like yourself that are up in the northern tier of the country, and Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, the colder, shorter season areas. That's an excellent gardening magazine. I would recommend
those
two.
I think
those
guys are in Bozeman, Montana. Excellent.
Exactly.
Good to hear, yes, and glad to hear magazines are still popular.
I know. It's like the last thing I want to be doing is having to read all this stuff on my smartphone. I don't even have a smartphone,
right?
So anyway, I couldn't read it. I'm kind of dumb when it comes to phones, so I don't want to waste my time. I like to engage. I don't like to spend all my time on a smartphone.
Yeah, I'm a mobile girl. I love my smartphone. I'll never be without it. But but I don't like to read on it. And I finally broke down and got a Kindle, and I don't really like to read on my Kindle either. But no, I'm definitely, give me the book, give me the newspaper, give me the magazine in my hand. Want to feel the paper, turn the page. But I definitely could come up with a million reasons why I love my phone. And what I do on it besides just reading. So,
I think
anyway,
I'm in the minority with my opinion.
you know, it's just all whatever. You know, I'm a mobile girl. I live on the road. I spend a lot of time in my car, and I like to make use of every spare minute I've got. So, and I don't know. I argue with my mom all the time. She thinks I'm just zoned out in it, and I think, you know, I'm connecting with other people. Like, I'm not just limited by where I live, which especially, thank God, because I live in Montana. But even in New York, like, I grew up in New York, and when I was there, it's nice to be able to connect with people that are like-minded, I think, is the biggest thing about communicating in the 21st century, is it's so much easier to find people that think like you do instead of just having to get along with the person who lives next door to you just because of location. I think it just makes it so you can reach out to people more. Like, look, I'm talking to you today. Anyway, if so, how about some business advice for people? Like, if they wanted to get started in the landscaping or flower industry, or you know, I just loved how you started out talking about, you know, clients first, customers first. How can I make my customers successful? Like, got any advice for people that maybe want to start a gardening business or anything?
Well, the horticultural profession is kind of like teaching. It's very important, but you don't get paid much. Well, I would say for folks that are interested in opening a retail greenhouse or garden center or nursery, plant a display garden. That'll be the best time and money you ever spend. Very, very important. I think it's you need to. I think it's a lot of extra work, but if you can grow what you sell as much as possible. Now, that's not always. I stopped growing all my own trees. It just got to be too expensive, and it was better to go to specialty nurseries. But certainly, with your annuals and perennials, that's something that is very important. I think that growing it yourself will give you so much insight and knowledge to pass along to your customer about how to take care of and be successful with a plant in their yard comes from hands-on experience that one would gain by growing the plants that you sell.
Cool.
And sell organic products. Just reject reject all those all the Scotts and all of those huge chemical conglomerates. Leave those products on the shelf. Don't sell that kind of garbage. Sell organic products. Support local composters. That sort of thing.
Excellent. I love that. I was thinking of something else. I'll think of it in a minute. Okay, final question. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, David, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally or on a national or global scale?
I would say become rabidly anti-Monsanto. Rapidly,
okay.
Anti-Monsanto and the ilk, Dow Chemical, all those giant. I can't think of the name of it. There's these huge industrial food producers that we just have to. I don't know if your listeners have heard, but you know they just. Approved a new herbicide-ready Monsanto GMO crops. Now they're not only are they going to be spraying Roundup everywhere, they're going to be spraying 2,4-D everywhere. They've come out with Roundup and 2,4-D resistant crops to fight superweeds. Now, if that doesn't send a chill down your spine, I don't know what will. But that's what we need to concentrate on. Is we have to fight these corporations like Monsanto that are it is their published desire to control the world's food supply, and they're going to do that through genetically modified organisms. That's my fervent belief. Become anti-Monsanto.
Excellent. You know, so my friend Carol, that I was telling you at the beginning. Talked this morning about the Millions March Against Monsanto, talked about this book called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. And it's the evidence that says exactly what you just said. This lawyer who has been researching this for 20 years, this Stephen Drucker, who's a public interest attorney, you know, has researched this and talks about back in the 80s, the Ronald Reagan administration actually published that their they wanted to dominate the world agriculture and food supply.
Yep.
And so hopefully
it's
listeners,
just,
this is going to go out after the march, but you can always go next year if you didn't make it this year. And most importantly, just, you know, learn about it and you know, talk to people about it. Talk to your neighbor. You know, the most change in our country comes from those conversations people have at the water cooler. It always starts there. So, you know, if somebody just even mentioning it to people helps spread the word, I think. So thanks for bringing that up, David. So just finally, do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Oh, one last thing I'd like to say before I get to that, Jackie. Sometimes people need a symbol to rally behind. And I think nothing more dramatically illustrates the need to be anti-Monsanto than the monarch butterfly. Do you know that they're considering it, putting it on the endangered species list?
That's crazy.
That's like,
yeah, I did just see something about that.
It's the 21st century passenger pigeon. And it's a direct result of Monsanto and all of the, you know, Midland Archer. That's the other company I wanted to mention, because they're the ones that are deforesting all the rainforest to plant soybeans. Midland Archer. But people should just put in their mind the monarch, and that there's a real possibility that this butterfly that we used to see everywhere is going to be going extinct because of Monsanto, directly because of Monsanto. So I think that we need to rally behind a symbol, and that's the symbol of this anti-corporate GMO mentality that's starting to dominate, is save the monarch. I think that's so
cool.
Important. What is important in terms of getting people to put their hands in the soil?
Okay.
I'd say grow a radish, grow a zinnia,
okay.
Eat something you pull from the ground, bring into the house something that you cut from the garden, and grow a plant, grow a salvia, and bring a hummingbird into your yard. I would say if people do those three things, that something is going to strike a chord and hopefully inspire folks to do more and to learn more. You don't have to do everything all at once, but just connect with your garden, because plants are our direct connection with the earth. And so there's no better way to connect with our earth than through plants. So eat one, cut one, provide natural nectar for one, is what I would say to people.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, when I was just reading on your blog this morning, you were talking about that salvia is something you can grow to kind of deter the deer. Is that right? Is that what I was reading in your blog? The salvia, lavender, and what was rosemary? There were three things that you said that
might
deter the deer away from your plants?
Yes. Well, you know, plants can't get up and move, so they have to defend themselves chemically. And salvias and lavender, not only do their internal chemicals keep away deer and rabbits and other browsers, but they also, in the case of lavender, provide us with just a wonderful healing aromatherapy type oils and things like that. So absolutely, plants are tremendously valuable for providing us with natural perfumes, and as well as keeping critters out of the garden. Dual purpose.
Okay, I didn't realize that that could do that, and it gives me another reason to buy some more lavender plants. I have to say, I have never been very successful in growing lavender. I think that's a tough one to grow. And that, I don't know, does lavender take a lot of sun? And maybe I just always put it in shady spots, and And that's my problem. It just seems like I have struggled with lavender over the years. I can't even think if I have a lavender plant in my garden right now that's come back.
I think for you, it's the cold. You know, lavenders, there's one variety. It's an heirloom variety called Vera, V-E-R-A, that is, once established, is cold hardy to, say, zone 4B. But in general, for you northern tier gardeners, it's the cold that is the limiting factor for growing lavender.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's it. All right.
Not your fault. It's the weather.
All right,
dang
I'm
it.
Just. Oh, that weather. That weather, man.
That weather.
So, David, do you want to tell people how to connect with you if they want to get a hold of you? Like, can they find you on maybe not Facebook, huh? But I'll put your website in the show notes, which is the High Country Gardens, right?
Yeah, that's the best way to get a hold of me is through High Country Gardens. I, as you guessed it, I don't do Facebook, and I don't do LinkedIn, and but I do email. So highcountrygardens.com at customer service is probably the best way to get through to me.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, David. I know this interview ended up going a little long, but I'm so glad you could take some time to talk with us today and have a wonderful day.
Well, thank you very much, Jackie. I really appreciate it. And I think some important things were said. So I hope that people enjoy it and hopefully learn a few things that they can use.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com, like awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. Thanks again for listening, and grow local.